welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. This is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce, and I got Kim on the controls, and hopefully Mike Roy is going to join us on the phone, although he is currently playing AWOL on us, so hopefully he'll call in a bit. But in the meantime, I had the distinct pleasure over the last week of interviewing some of the most fascinating people on the planet when we talk about peaceful protesting around the world and how to make that work for you. I mean, a couple of significant events that have happened where, you know, we've had dramatic victories with peaceful protest. I mean, probably the biggest one is the student movement in Quebec, who just ousted a premier, ditched two education ministers, and won their battle against tuition increases. And so I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing Gabrielle Nadeau-Edouard, and I probably got that wrong, and Chloe Zawatsky Turcotte on the weekend. And I'm old and blind, and there's not a lot of light here in the studio, so I can't even read my own notes here. But, you know, we'll do our best here at CHRW and just put out apologies because I screw up everybody's names. And we also talked to Ethan Cox, who is a journalist for rabble.ca, who was very involved in the in following the Quebec student movement. We also have an interview with Lee McKenna, who is a wonderful lady who has worked around the world with the UN and various other agencies. And I caught up with her at the London Public Library. And that was fantastic. And I've got an interview with her about this. So, and, you know, just to get us started here with the show, you know, peaceful protests have a mandate. And Tim Carey from CAW Local 27 here in town is a huge advocate of the Occupy movement and peaceful protesting and the connection therein with labor. And he made the intros Saturday on the presentation, and we've got that for you now.
100% isn't worried about their kids going to university by getting an education. It's an issue for the 99%, and it's an issue for working people to be able to, one, keep a job, which is more and more difficult today, and two, have the hopes and aspirations that their children can go to school and go all the way through to university. I never had that good fortune of being raised in poverty, and I certainly don't want to see that continue to happen. So the fight in Quebec is so proud of what Quebec does, not only the students done, but the progressive legislation in Quebec, the fight on social justice issues in Quebec, is something that people in Ontario, quite frankly, should be aspiring to. You're looking at the Quebec model and say, maybe if we did, we'd have a better country. So we have serious issues to deal with. We have serious governments that are attacking us on a daily basis. We've got provincial governments that say that parties can't have the right to collective bargaining. We got the highest tuition fees anywhere in the country, here in Ontario. We've got a government that's going to take away a right to strike fundamental to work. Boy, I tell you, if there's not a time for a fight back, I don't know what is. So we'll be there with you in support of labor. There's no doubt about it. You inspire us.
And I mean, this is a time when, unfortunately, we're having to fight back on a regular basis. Stephen Harper is running this country basically as a dictatorship, and you know, he did promise us that we wouldn't recognize Canada when he was done with it. And, well, you know, he's living up to his promise because, you know, every single day Canada looks less and less like the country we know and love. So, I caught up with Lee McKenna, who has been involved in peaceful protests around the world, the current Freedom boat to Gaza. She trained all of the individuals on that boat on peaceful protest techniques. She's a world activist, and she's actually from my hometown. So her and I, we know each other personally, and it was absolutely fantastic to catch up with her and hear her views on peaceful protests. I hear from Lee because the tape's fouled. So, but basically what she says is that we have to continuously be on top of this, and we have to continuously keep writing letters to Stephen Harper, and we have to keep working on this on a daily basis because it's a constant struggle to do that, and we'll try to get that tape a little bit later for you if we can figure out the technical glitch on it. So yeah, I mean, the main point of this show is talking about the student strike in Quebec, which was a 6-month engagement, and there's a lot of differences between Quebec and Ontario, and I was absolutely blessed to to hear the actual people that brought this strike to Quebec and actually worked on it and did what they needed to do to get the job done, and to introduce some of the differences in the politics. I caught up with Ethan Cox from Rabble.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ethan Cox. I'm a journalist with Rabble.ca and Canada.com. First of all, I want to thank you all so much for coming out. It's really great to see all of you here. And it's actually the first stop on a tour that's going to take us all the way out west to Vancouver. So before we go on, I just wanted to introduce my fellow panelists. This is Joy Zawadzki-Turcotte. And she's a former executive with CLASS and a university student at the University of Quebec at Montreal. And Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, doesn't really need too much introduction. He's the former spokesperson for CLASS and probably the most recognizable face of the student movement in Quebec. But about the political context in Quebec, Gabriel is going to talk the background to the student strike and the student movement in Quebec. And then Chloe is going to talk more about the sort of nuts and bolts and the specifics of what was done in order to be able to build up to the student strike and to this mobilization, because it didn't come out of nowhere, and it wasn't a matter of snapping fingers and going, okay, great, now we got 400,000 people in the street. I guess, first of all, I'll just give you a quick primer on Quebec politics, because not everybody may be familiar. Prior to the election that just happened, the Quebec Liberals of Jean Charest were in power for 9 years. He is an extremely right-wing neoliberal government, which tried twice to attack students. First in 2005, when currently the loan and bursary system in Quebec works, that when people get a loan, 60% of that is a bursary that they don't have to repay, and 40% of the loan. And so in 2005, the Quebec government tried to transform the bursary into a loan so that loans would be 100% repayable. And there was a major student strike at that time, which also succeeded and was able to force the government to back down and restore the system to the way it was. And then again, obviously, this year, the government tried to raise tuition massively, and again, were beaten. And so it's somewhat incontestable that what just happened in Quebec was a major victory for students. The resume of the student strike in the province of Quebec is the resignation of two education ministers, the defeat of a premier in a sitting government, and the repeal of not only the tuition hike, but also of Law 12. For those of you who are not familiar with that, that's a law that was brought in by the Charest government about midway through the strike to try and quell protests. It was condemned by everyone from the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights, to every human rights and civil liberties group, the Quebec Bar Association representing lawyers and prosecutors in the province. It required anyone who wanted to hold a protest to give the police 8 hours notice and allow the police to say, no, you can't have a protest. It bars protests within 50 meters of an educational institution, which effectively bars protests in downtown Montreal because we have so many educational institutions with scattered campuses that there isn't really any real estate that wouldn't be covered by that. It's been a major victory in Quebec, but it's not a complete victory. And I think what you're going to hear from these guys is that the goal of class is to move towards free education. It's a mistake when we talk about education funding to really get bogged down in the dollars and cents of it. When you're a student militant, your perspective is a little bit simpler. It should be free, and therefore we want it to be free. Having done the research and the work on a public policy basis, the flip side of that is we should all want it to be free. Education is the single best investment that any government can make in the future prosperity of society. A number of studies have been done in Europe and here that show that for every dollar invested in post-secondary education returns $10 over the lifetime of a graduate in the higher taxes that they pay. Really, regardless of your perspective, regardless if you're a right-winger and you don't believe in helping people out, if you just want to have a prosperous society, it makes absolute sense to make education free and to have people repay that investment through a progressive taxation scheme, rather than saddling students at the beginning of their lives when they're least able to pay with crushing debt loads. And another thing that often gets overlooked in this conversation is that when most of our students are graduating from university with crushing debt loads, what that means is that when they come out of university, they're forced to immediately seek the highest paying jobs that they can. So whereas in the past, the top graduates from any law school would go and start storefront legal aid companies. Now they don't have that option. They have to go and get a job with a big law firm because they need to pay back their loan. Whereas in the past, if Steve Jobs would pull around in his garage and invent Apple, well, there's no room for that. Because the Steve Jobs, if he graduated from university today, would have too much debt to do that, and he'd need to go find a job right away. So something that's often overlooked is the impact of student debt on society.
And that's Ethan. And, I mean, that's the first point that we're going to make on this show about the student strike and how tuition increases have a dramatic effect on society as a whole. And two of the other points that we want to bring home really, really clear about the student strike is that the media has painted the students as, you know, they already have the lowest tuition rates in the country. And so why are they bitching so bad? And why are they protesting? And the reasons that they're protesting is because Quebec has some very, very unique education opportunities that aren't available to others across the country. And so those students were protecting more than just their pocketbooks. They were protecting Quebec society as a whole. And no one says that more better than this short interview with Gabriel, who was the spokesperson for class and who talks about the social implications of it all. And it's the Gabriel interview, the short one, not the long one.
Yes, my name is Guilherme Dubois. I was the main spokesperson of the student movement in Quebec in the last month. Spokesperson of CLASS, which was the union representing 70% of the student class.
Can we talk a little bit? You talked a lot about the cultural shift and the barrier measures that are causing our universities to change. Can you talk about that and how that played into all of this?
Well, what was clear when the government announced his increasing tuition fees is that the objective of the measure was not to, for example, put more money in universities. The objective was really to change the way, to change really the political culture of Quebec, to change, in fact, the Quebec society from a society with strong public services, an accessible education system, to a society where public services are paid with user fees. That's the case in health, but also the case in education. And what is behind this decision of increasing tuition fees is precisely this ideology of privatizing university, you know, transforming universities from a free area of thinking, an area of academic freedom, and of questioning society, to a place where people go to get a job and a place where corporations invest in order to develop new technology, then that's really the shift, that thing that is behind increasing efficiency.
And you feel very elegantly about that. And can you talk about class as a peaceful organization versus militant organization, and how, I mean, a lot of that played out in mainstream media, and a lot of it was misrepresented. Can you talk about class's mandate?
Well, we are a student union, so our mandate is to, you know, was to put pressure on the government in order to make sure that the demands of the students were heard by the government. And that's why we went on strike. That's why we did major protests. And that's why we, when the law was accepted, we had no choice but to go into peaceful civil disobedience in order to make sure that this law was not going to be applied. Obviously, we were never a violent organization, even if that's exactly what the government was saying. I think that there was, our conflict in Quebec was a violent conflict. But the violence was the violence of the police. And it was the economic violence of putting thousands of students outside the university. I don't think that protesting, I don't think that having picket lines is violent.
And what would you say to the police for next time?
I would say them to try to respect the freedom that we have to protest and to take collective decisions to go on strike. And I think one of the impacts of our strike is exactly it has opened the eyes of a lot of persons on the violence of our system that claims to be a peaceful system and that always puts violence in the hands of the people who contest the system. I think we are in a violent system, and I don't think that we were violent.
Any regrets?
Well, I think sometimes the media and the government succeeded in disturbing us and succeeded in imposing some debates that were not the debates that we wanted to have. I think we talked too much about those issues of violence. I think we talked too much about so many peripheral issues. I think we should have focused a little bit more on the reason why we were on strike. And I think we were distracted a few times by the media. But, you know, no struggle is perfect, but every struggle is better than the other one before.
Congratulations on a success. And what are your plans now?
Well, personally, my plan is to continue my diploma. I want to finish my my degree in history and philosophy. And obviously, I will continue to be in the streets with students, women, workers, and everyone who is oppressed by our government.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was Gabriel, who spoke very elegantly about the culture shift. And in the second half of the show, we actually have his presentation Saturday at King's College here in London, or King's University here in London. And he speaks a lot more about that culture shift and how that is relevant to the student strike, which is pretty much fundamental to what they were fighting for. You know, money is money, but changing how and who can go to school is more important than the dollars and cents. And he makes that very clear after the break. But how did they manage to mobilize this? How did they manage to mobilize hundreds of thousands of students in the streets in peaceful protests against the strike and everything else? And to start that conversation a little bit is Chloe. And unfortunately, equipment wasn't working very good on me Saturday. So the tape quality on this stuff isn't as good as it could have been. But please do your best to listen through it. You know, Chloe has a lot of important stuff to say, and this is just some of it.
Now, the important thing that we have to understand is how the way that the movement works on the inside, because that's what's particular in it. What's particular is that it's very democratic, but also it has a certain form of centralization. So how it works is that every local communion make their decision in some general assemblies. Usually you have once a semester you have the general assembly in every local community. during the strike, of course, we had a general assembly every week, because then the decisions that are made in the local student union in the general assembly are taken to a congress with the decision making. And in every congress, you have delegates from every student union from all over Quebec. So you have delegates, 1 to 3 normally delegates from every student union. The people are used to being involved in the process of decision making because they are always the ones that are first bringing the proposals in their general assembly that are then debated between the members of the local union and then brought to the conference by the delegates and then debated between the different unions in the congress, and that's how we make decisions on a national level. That's how we think that in Quebec we succeeded, and we had a so strong movement because people, as Ethan was saying earlier, really feel that they're a part of the movement, that are really involved in it and in the process of the decision making and everything.
And Chloe went on further to say things like, and when I asked her about violence and the police violence, and class had a very difficult decision because, you know, some of the people were, you know, smashing windows and doing violent acts on property. And class made a decision that they would condone any violence against a person. But they wouldn't separate and they wouldn't spend effort on talking and discussing and alienating those that practiced violence against or smashing of private property or anything else, because they felt that just distracted everybody from the main message, and rightfully so. And Gabriel talked about how the press, and they allowed the press to get them into conversations that were off message. And you know, when you're doing this kind of peaceful protest, you know, you've got to be very, very vigilant about keeping your message on track and not allowing others to design and change your messaging in any way, shape, or form. And you know, that's one of the lessons that they learned out of the student strike. But another thing that she talked about was that the most of the violence that was being perpetrated against the person was by police. And she talked very, very much about one of her best friends who lost their eye in police violence. And they were a very, very, very calm and nonviolent person. And when attacked by police, the police actually caused them to lose sight in one eye. And you know, that's not acceptable in any way when you're talking about these peaceful protests. And we need to learn a lot about how to deal with public dissension in this country. And we really need to get the message to police forces across the country and around the world that a militant and violent approach to peaceful engagement is not okay and it's not acceptable. And you know, it's important that we have the ability to protest in this country. And, you know, it's fundamental to our ability to affect democracy. And, you know, one of the things that, Lee McKenna spoke about is the fact that, you know, we've almost won the pipeline project across Western Canada, and we could have simply just dropped ourselves, down, and we could have just given up and said, oh, some people are going to make some money on it and we don't like it, but we're just too tired, or there's just nothing we can do. But we haven't. And because of that, it looks like the pipeline is not going to happen. You know, there's already political pressure to use existing pipelines and move the oil east instead of west to refine it within Canada, so we have jobs and job creation, and we can profit off of Canadian oil rather than shipping it off to a foreign country and allowing them to profit while we get a couple hundred jobs maintaining a pipeline that's going to endanger so many species of creatures that are on the endangered list that it is not even remotely feasible to put that much endangerment of the natural environment for a pipeline that shouldn't exist and doesn't need to exist. So peaceful protest is an important part of the democratic process. And, you know, we need to alter how we view that process, and we need to, you know, keep up the pressure on our government and our governments and, you know, make sure that they understand when they're doing things that are contrary to everything that we are as Canadians and as international citizens. So, we'll be back after the break here at CHRW 94.9 FM.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can do better.
And welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce, and this is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. And we're talking about peaceful demonstrations here on the show today, and exclusive interviews with you know, some fascinating people that changed the world in Quebec. And so I thought maybe that what we would do is I will bring you Gabriel's entire presentation that he gave at King's University on Saturday for you. So this is Gabriel.
My name is Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois. I am a student in history and philosophy in the University of Quebec at Montreal. I'm a student activist for 6 years now, since my college. I'm really a child of the 2005 strike. And I was elected on April 2010 as the spokesperson of class, which at the time was a little student union, the third one in importance in Quebec. In the last month, we have begun the first student organization in Quebec with more than 100,000 members, representing 70% of the students that were in strike in the last month in Quebec. So this puts us in this very particular situation where we are the bigger student union, but also the more militant. And we are pretty proud of that. I want to begin by explaining a little bit the context in which this decision was announced. This tuition increase was announced in the 2010 budget by the Liberal government of Jean Charest. At the moment, described his budget two days before it was adopted as a cultural revolution. And it can be very funny to see that a Liberal minister uses this kind of expression to justify his measures, to say the cultural revolution. But I always found that very interesting, to see that the guy who is responsible for this increasing of tuition fees recognizes when he presents his budget that in fact it's not an economic decision, it is not a financial decision, it's a cultural decision, it's an ideological decision. But in this budget, there was not only an increasing tuition. And when Mr. Bachand says it's a cultural revolution, what he means is very clear, and he was explaining it like that. The objective of his budget was to break the historical political culture of Quebec, which is to have taxpayer public services financed by a tax scheme that is progressive and that asks every worker, every citizen to pay his fair share in the financing of the public services and under state in general. So when Mr. Bachand says tangibly it's a cultural revolution, what he means is that this budget is about changing the political culture of Quebec. It's about breaking the social democrat system based on redistribution of wealth, which is not a perfect system, obviously. But that still is able to control the difference between the rich and the poor. So to break this social democratic system and transform it into what we can call a more Anglo-Saxon Anglo-Saxon model of privatization of public services and user fees. This decision of decreasing tuition fees has two major impacts, not only on students, but on society in general. And I'll try to need to briefly explain what were those two big consequences, because those two themes have been really the two major issues on which we have been mobilizing since now maybe 3 years to be able to have this huge student strike. Well, the first impact of an increasing admission is very clear. It's known. It's an attack to accessibility to post-secondary education. Because unlike what is said in the mainstream media, the Quebec model of low tuition fees historically have had a very clear impact on accessibility to university for citizens and especially for Minnesota. Quebec is the province in Canada where there are more students from the middle class in programs like medicine, pharmacy, and engineering. It's also the province in Canada where you can find in the universities the more students from remote areas where there are no universities. And it's also the province in Canada where you have the more what we call first generation students. These are students that are the first of their family to ever go to university. And in Quebec, more than half of the students in university are first generation students. And so that clear impact. Also, there is an institution that we're very proud of in the Quebec student movement, which is called the Cégep. That is something very unique in Quebec, doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. It's a mandatory, transitory, free college between high school and university. And those colleges are free. The fact that we have very low tuition fees in universities and those free colleges, the combined effect of those two traditions in Quebec, makes that we have the post-secondary frequentation rate of 9% over the Canadian average. And in the media, when you hear colleges talk about our policy of low tuition fees, you will always even say, you know, Quebec has very low tuition fees, but their university frequentation rate is one of the lowest in the country. And then the logic to conclude, so a policy of low tuition increase has no impact on accessibility to education. This way of thinking is wrong for two reasons. First, because it forgets the fact that we have those colleges on the suggest. And for example, in many provinces in Canada, if you want to become a nurse, you have to go to university and then pay tuition fees. If you want to become a nurse in Quebec, you only have to go to Cégep, which is free, and you become a nurse. So the fact that those professions are seized in the Cégep obviously makes that there are less students going to the residency. But when you take the post-secondary presentation, so you say, let's see in Quebec and in the rest of Canada, what is the proportion of students that will continue to go to school after high school, then you realize that because we have those subjects and those tuition fees, we have a presentation rate that is 9% above the Canadian average. And if we listen to liberals and reach the Canadian half of tuition fees, we will probably also reach the Canadian half of post-secondary frequentation. And that, for us, is not a good objective to pursue. The second reason why this reason is to say if you raise tuition fees, there's no impact on accessibility is because, for example, in programs like medicine in Quebec, our universities accept approximately one student out of four that applies to the program of medicine. So even if we decided to triple tuition, the medicine faculty would still be full. There will still be the same amount of students having a medicine diploma. And then the right wing, as you see, there's no impact on accessibility because there are the same number of students going out to the university. The problem is that in those programs that are very difficult to accept, yes, there will be the same number of diplomas, but the students adding that deployment, it won't be the same. It won't come from the same families, it won't come from the same neighborhood, it won't come from the same socioeconomic background. So the first impact of increasing affluence is not to make that there will be less people in the university. I mean, we could multiply by 10 tuition fees, and universities won't be empty. I mean, they will think there will be people in the medical class, but the fact is that those people won't be the same. They will come from rich families and not from middle class families or worker families. So that was the first, the very brief overview I can do about our argument about the impact of tuition fees on accessibility to universities. The second theme of our mobilization in the last month, in the last years in Quebec, has been to try to make the students understand that this tuition has to be understood in a much larger context, a much larger tendency to the privatization of post-secondary education. In French, we say marchandisation, which comes from marchandise. In English, we say commodification of education and of university. It's a very complex thing to talk about. I won't have the time, obviously, to go all through it, but I'll try to, once again, do a brief overview. Like Ethan explained a little bit, since the hand of Fordism, the global economy has changed a lot. Capitalism has changed a lot. As we all know, the economies of the North, just like the Canadian or Quebec economy, do not function anymore on manufacturing things. The majority of the very concrete work to make, you know, objects have been displaced in the Asian countries or more generally South countries. So the economies of the developed countries are more and more what we call in French l'économie de savoir, the knowledge economy. An economy that is not based on creating objects, but that is based on developing ideas. Developing ideas and obviously putting the hand on it to be sure that the money that will be made in the South by exporting this idea will come back to us. So briefly we can say it's an economy of creation and conception. We create things, we think things, and then there are manufacturers elsewhere in the world. So profit doesn't lie anymore in making things. It lies now in developing ideas. But the problem with research and development, because that's what we're talking about, the problem with research and development is that it's very, very expensive. And there are a lot of risks to research and development for private corporations, because you need to put millions and millions of dollars in order to try to find something. And if you don't find it, well, you lose the money. So that's why since maybe the 80s, we have seen private corporations trying to find a way to make research and development without having to bear the risk of it. And then appears this institution where you have hundreds, thousands of students, intelligent people, massively funded by public money, that are supposed to be in those institutions to exactly do that, develop new knowledge, develop new ideas. So that's why big corporations quickly saw in the university the perfect institution for them to make research and development without bearing the risk of it, and making sure that the ideas and technology that will be developed in the university will be funded by public money, but that the profit will come back into their hands. And this is why, and this is like the root of this dynamic of privatization of post-secondary education. So what happened very briefly is that corporations turned to an institution that is called university, that is funded by public money, and that will be ready to make those research and this development at a much cheaper price. So more than ever today, and more than ever in their history, universities are being placed in the very heart of capitalism. And that's why you will never hear a right-wing party saying that education and universities are not important. They will, in Quebec, it's fascinating to see how the, what is that?
The Chamber of Commerce.
The big Chamber of Commerce, the right-wing party, the big businessmen, they all agree on one thing. Education is the future of Quebec. But in fact, when they talk about the future of Quebec, they talk about the future of the economy. They don't talk about the future of society, and when they talk about economy, obviously we know what they mean. When they talk about economy, they talk about their own problems. So in brief, for capitalism, universities are probably, like Ethan said, their last hope for, survival. Because it probably was the last place where they could develop those technologies without having to bear this unbelievable pressure and risk on an economic level. So the plan of the 1% is not to say that education is unimportant. The plan of the 1% is, at the opposite, to put university in really the core of the new global capitalism. But if you want to put university in the center of capitalism, you have to change something that don't fit in capitalism, that historically are part of this institution that is called university. First, First, you have to privatize the funding of the university. Because if the funding is still, if the funding is as the way it is now, your university will be reluctant to really totally enter into global capitalism. And you have also to privatize the activities of universities. You have to change what the universities do. Because if they keep on thinking about the relation between Foucault and Deleuze, it's not good. You have to change what the people actually do with universities. And what is wonderful for the right wing with the tuition increase is that it does both. Tuition increase does two things. It privatizes the funding of the university and it contributes to changing activities at the university. So first thing is very simple. When you increase tuition fees, you privatize the funding of universities. Because what has been observed everywhere in the world is that contrary to what is said by the media and by the people who want to increase tuition fees, when tuition fees increase, for example, by 75%, the public funding of universities is reduced from 75%. That's what happened in 1919 Quebec, when the tuition fees were increased. And it's what happened in England also. It's what happened everywhere when the tuition fees increased. They say universities are underfunded. We have to put more money in. The fact that they do is not put more money in it. They just change the place from where the money comes from. But in fact, there is the same amount of money in the university. So when you increase tuition fees, you privatize the funding. Very simple. So you pass from a university that is funded publicly by taxes to a university that is funded by individual and also by philanthropy, which is this new thing saying that, yeah, we will also ask the corporations to do their part in the funding of education, who will open this foundation, and then where the corporations will be able to give money. Obviously, when corporations give money voluntarily, it's not because they think that the history of art should be teach very seriously. They do it because they see an interest, an interest in funding. So they will obviously fund the university from certain tools, from certain programs, and even in Quebec, what we are beginning to see, and I guess that it's already the case here, we are seeing corporations giving money to specific teachers in specific classrooms for specific courses. Because they don't have, if this program and this curriculum is rightly funded, we will profit from it. So that's the sort of the first thing. But and here you see the second way why tuition increase changes the activities of the university, because we already said it privatizes the funding, but it also privatizes the activities, because the new funding that is generated by the private sector will be directed into certain sectors of the university more than others. But when you increase tuition, you also change the very nature of university, the very mission. Because when you increase tuition, the first impact, even before the impact on accessibility, is an impact on indebtedness. It's really a terrible word in this system. On this money, well, the fact that students are debt. And how can I say, debt is a very efficient disciplinary process for students. When you know that as a student, going to university will have a consequence that you will have a $40,000 debt, well, you will be very careful in choosing the good university and the good program. So when you increase tuition fees, you naturally say to the students that they have to shop their education. And even if you are very generous person, a very left-wing activist, if you know that by going to university you're going to have a huge debt, naturally it's going to be your reflect. You're going to begin as young as 16 or 17 years old to think your own education as an economic investment. So when you create student debt, what do? Well, you are able to put in the head of a very young adult beginning in life the idea that public institutions are there for him, for his personal and financial interest. So you are not only able, when you increase tuition fees, to change the university, but you are also able to change the nature of the relation between the student and the institution, between the student and his own education. Because you put in his head that choose a good program and choose a good university, because if you don't, you will have a huge debt and you won't be able to pay for it after. So when you are in front as a student of that kind of dilemma, obviously philosophy, literature, fine art seem suddenly a lot less interesting. But engineering, medicine, and all those very applied science will suddenly look very good. So when you increase tuition, like I said, you are able to modify the relation that the student, that the very young student, from 16 or 17 years old, will have to his own education. And, you know, one of the big arguments that was used by the liberal government to justify the tuition increase was that, education is an investment on your future. In French, they say, it's a native. It's an investment on your human capital, your own little, capital. And when you increase tuition fees, it's the prophecy realizing itself. Because when you increase tuition fees, you will actually succeed to make the students think like that. So that's where you change the relation, like I said, between the students and the institution, and consequently, also between the student and the teacher, the student and society itself. When you convince a 17 or 18-year-old student that education is a commodity, well, you are sure now that he is totally ready to be part of the capitalist world of work and credit. If you put youth into debt, you create an obedience. So I always talk too much, so I will end fast now, but briefly, let's say that the process of privatizing the university, in the process of privatizing the university, the economic elite has to obviously, like I said, change the funding of universities from a public funding to a private, philanthropic, and individual funding. They have also to change the activity of universities from teaching activity to from teaching and fundamental research to commercial research. You change also the programs that the student, the choice of programs of the student, and you will change the student, you will change how they see their own education. And if you want to transform education into, if you want to transform university into enterprises, well, you have to make sure that everyone in the university is on the same, that everyone in the university understands but now they are working in a private enterprise. And tuition fees do those three things. And that's why it is so important. And I tend to think that the proof that we're right in this analysis is the fact that it has been impossible for us to make the Liberals go back on their decision of increasing tuition. In 2005, it was about a changement in the bursaries and loans. They were trying, you know, to take 102 million dollars. You know? And it, when you read the budget in 2005, it wasn't a footnote. It was a footnote in the budget. At that time, it was really a financial decision. What we have realized this year in Quebec is that, at the opposite, the decision of increasing tuition fees, it was not in the footnote of the budget. It was the main measure of the budget. They had an unbelievable number of strategic communication experts working for them in order to make sure that this measure would be approved. They did video, they did website. And in 2005, we did an 8-week strike. And they went back to me. They said, okay, we give back the money. It was, let's say, easy compared to this year. We did, I don't know, 25, I don't know. And 6 months, and they never went back. They preferred to apply a totally unconstitutional law than to go back in time. They preferred to start an election a year and a half before they were supposed to do it, because they wanted to increase tuition fees. Why is the elite so upset with this idea? Why does the liberal have been totally incapable of going back on that decision? Even when, and I can say because I was there, even when we were negotiating with the minister in Quebec, we found a solution for them that, okay, we found a trick in the budget to say that they will not raise tuition, but that they will not put one more money in education, and then universities will have the same budget. And even there, they refuse our deal. So I think that proves the ideological importance of the tuition increase and the ideological importance of privatizing universities for the survival of capitalism. And that's why I honestly think that if we want to develop a strategy to worldwide, we begin to beat the austerity agenda, I think the student movement, not only in Quebec, in Canada, in Chile, but all around the world, will have to be at the very front of it. I think students have now the responsibility to be the first in the street against this complete disaster that is global capitalism. Because as students and as teachers, and I see a lot of teachers in the classroom, we are the last, the last inheritance. We inherit from this institution that is called university, that was one invented to make sure that society has a way, as a place where it can discuss itself. An institution that should be the source of critical thinking and of freedom, and it's not a detail if now, when the economic system is in crisis, the elite is attacking this institution first. It's because education in university historically has been our faith, and maybe I think that's because I'm a student, but I think those institutions, and I think education in general, have been probably the first source of our crisis.
You've been listening to CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce, and this has been Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. Check our blogs online at www.betweenthemargins.ca, and hopefully you have your happily ever after, whatever that may look like to you.